On the first day of worst foot, my true love sent to me bees, really angry bees. Happy Christmas, everybody!
Particularly to all beekeepers, because do you know how hard it is to get a little Santa hat and beard on each and every one of them?
Happy Christmas, everybody, from myself and Ben. This is your Christmas special episode, and we're doing something a little bit different this year. We've sort of taken the mold we often use for the third foot, where we go and look at one specific subject in a bit of detail, just the two of us, and we thought we'd expand that into a Christmas special all about the song, The 12 Days of Christmas.
And don't worry, Jewish friends, next year we'll be taking you through a verse-by-verse analysis of the Hanukkah classic Mo'at Tzur.
you say analysis, it'll be, you'll be analysing and I'll be there at the sidelines going, yeah, I agree with what Ben said.
And you'll be at the side going, are you sure the Maccabees were freedom fighters and not terrorists?
I'm laughing, but I don't know what that means.
Yeah. Do you not know the story of Hanukkah at all?
No. I've not been raised in that faith, but also in Ireland, when you do religious education, it's basically you're just studying Catholicism.
Catholicism, and here's why the proddies are wrong.
Yeah, precisely, yeah.
Broad brushstrokes for Hanukkah. The Greeks were bullying the Jews and owned Jerusalem at that time. And so the Maccabees, I want to said they were led by Judah Maccabee, although that does sound like a kosher professional wrestler who was cooked up by the WWE. But he was resisting against them. And the naughty thing that the Greeks did was destroy the menorah in the temple. And there was only that had to be kept lit to keep God happy.
And there was
gotta
only enough.
Gotta keep it lit.
Gotta keep it lit. God is very fastidious about his lighting. God is like your dad with central heating. And there was only enough olive oil to keep it lit for one day. And they couldn't just pop down at the local corner shop or bodega, as I've learned, if you're American, and get some oil. And to make olive oil to last for enough time would take 8 days. But miraculously, the oil that was meant to burn for one day actually burnt for 8 days. My, what an incredible MacGuffin is at the heart of the Hanukkah story.
So you're saying that Hanukkah is based on the same thing that you get with fairy liquid bottles, where they last far longer than you actually think they should?
Yeah, Hanukkah is basically about wartime thriftiness.
Yeah. Well, now that everyone's learned that, they can learn about the 12 days of Christmas. And we shouldn't talk about religion too much, because it is Christmas. Religion and politics are off the table for our Christmas special. Or maybe not, depending on what research we've brought in. Basically, Ben and I have gone through the song The 12 Days of Christmas. I've taken the odd numbers, Ben's taken the even numbers, and we've had a look at what we can find out about the various gifts that are gifted in the song. If you don't know the song, you can have a quick Google of it, but it was published first in England in 1780. Without any music, it was just a sort of chant or a rhyme.
Describing it as a chant makes it much creepier.
The only reason it's in any way tolerable is for the bit where everyone goes, five gold rings.
Yeah, I love Eddie Izzard's bit about that. I'm like, that's the best bit, where people will come in from different rooms, from different postcodes, just like coming through a skylight, five gold rings. Right, I'm just off back to do the washing now.
That bit and the tune that most people will know if they know the song is from a 1909 arrangement of the song by an English composer called Frederick Austin. And the traditional gifts, and we've gone for the order from that particular version because there are other versions and other gifts along the way, but they are on the first day of Christmas. It goes from on the first day of Christmas all the way to the 12th day of Christmas, and you get, in order, a partridge in a pear tree, 2 turtle doves, 3 French hens, 4 calling birds, 5 gold rings, 6 geese a-laying, 7 swans a-swimming, 8 maids a-milking, 9 ladies dancing, 10 lords a-leaping, 11 pipers piping, and 12 drummers drumming. Yes, but there were other gifts along the way. Did you have a look at some of the other gifts that could have been?
I saw the carefully tabulated Wikipedia article, and after 10 seconds thought, this is not for me.
I like that in some versions you could have got ships a-sailing, ladies spinning instead of ladies dancing, bells ringing, and fifers fifing.
Like a fife is a Scottish flute.
Yeah, it's a sort of a flute and a wind instrument. Bulls a-roaring, men a-mowing, hares a-running, badgers baiting. Ugh. Ducks are laying, lads are looping, whatever that means. Looping is kind of spelt like the French for wolf as well, so maybe it's like people turning into werewolves. I don't know.
Right.
Boys are singing, bears a beating and asses racing, which, if you don't cook your turkey well enough, guys, is a problem that might arise. So, you know, be careful. And if you want my favourite version of this song is the 1982 version by Frank Kelly called Christmas Countdown. Frank Kelly, the Irish actor who played Father Jack in Father Ted.
Oh, great.
He did a comedic version of it, which he appeared on Top of the Pops performing because it charted here in the UK at number 8 in Ireland and reached number 26 over here. And he basically plays a character called Gubnet O'Lunacy, or he pronounces it Gubnet O'Lunacy, who's writing a letter back to a woman called Nuala, thanking her in increasing frantic and vitriolic terms as he gets more and more animals and gifts sent to his house. I heartily recommend people go check it out. But shall we start the Christmas countdown at number one and work in ascending order?
Yeah, let's work our way through.
Right, partridges in pear trees. There is a Pear Tree Lane in London. There's a couple of them. There's a Pear Tree Lane in Wapping in London and Pear Tree Street in Clerkenwell. So if the comedic character Alan Partridge were to visit either of those, you'd get a real partridge in a pear tree. But I didn't realise pear leaves were smoked in Europe before tobacco was brought back from the Americas. And Ben, you're a connoisseur of various medicinal smokes. Have you ever...
Gentleman's Herbal Restorative,
there
please.
We go. Yes. Have you ever smoked a pear leaf?
I have not. I have obviously, as a teenager, dried and smoked banana skin for its hallucinogenic properties, and I can tell you that it's about as hallucinogenic as an episode of Are You Being Served? It is really nothing to it. I was not aware of this, and I have not enjoyed the pleasure.
Well, there you go. And apparently the Chinese consider the pear, they call it Li, to be a symbol of immortality. So if you destroy a pear tree, it's bad luck. It symbolises untimely death in China.
Oh, everything augurs untimely death in China.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, killing living thing equals untimely death probably seems to be pretty on the nose, actually. And then I read about partridges. Partridges are in decline in the UK, and the only thriving populations in England today apparently are found on the estates where they're shot.
So
they're a game bird, and a lot of people hunt them, and so they obviously try and maintain the populations of them at quite a high level for them to then decimate them.
God, that feels like a perfect encapsulation of the British aristocracy, doesn't it? And our approach to environmentalism, we shall preserve it so we can then destroy it.
Yeah. And apparently partridges also lay the biggest clutches of eggs of any birds. 14 to 15 eggs are quite common. And they were a really popular dish for Neanderthals and Cro-Magnon humans going back a long way. Like 35,000 years ago, they were eating partridges. So they had quite expensive taste, our prehistoric ancestors. But a partridge in a pear tree isn't a particularly good gift. In wintertime especially. A, partridges basically are ground-dwelling birds. They don't really fly very much. They can fly, but they prefer not to.
So if the partridge was in a pear tree, they'd be there going, could you call the ambulance? Not
yeah.
The ambulance.
Yeah.
Sorry. Could you call the fire service, please?
Yes. And a pear tree in the middle of winter, it's not a you know, an evergreen, so it'll be completely barren of leaves as well, or fruit. So it's basically an unhappy bird sitting in a skeletal tree.
That's the spirit of some people. That's the spirit of Scrooge Christmas, isn't it?
Yeah. But one thing I did read, just before I finish up on this, is that it's probably not what the original words were, or it's a mishearing of something. Cecil Sharp, who was a British compiler of lots of folk songs, he wrote in 1916 that from the constancy in English, French and Languedoc versions of the Merry Little Partridge, I suspect that pear tree is really perdrix, from the old French pertrice, carried into English. And juniper tree in some English versions may have been jolly perdrix. So in some versions of the song, they sing a juniper tree, and they think that's a mishearing of jolly perdrix. And perdrix is a French word based on an old legend of a man called Perdrix, who was an inventor. He was a student of Daedalus, as in Father of Icarus.
Yeah.
And Perdrix was walking along a beach and he saw the spine of a fish, and he made little notches in a piece of iron to invent the saw. So apparently Perdrix is the guy who invented the saw. But Daedalus was quite jealous of Perdrix's abilities, so he took him to the top of a tower and pushed him off it. hadn't invented the waxy wings at this point either. So Perdrix fell, but the gods apparently took mercy on him because he was, you know, a clever guy, and they turned him into a bird. And after...
halfway through the fall.
Yeah, but after the experience, he was really traumatized. So he was a bird that was afraid of heights and lived on the ground. So he is the origin of the first partridge. And there is a genus of partridge called Perdrix.
Oh, I like that. That's very enjoyable. That's like David Attenborough narrates Aesop's fables.
Yeah, exactly. So there you go. That's what I learned about partridges and pear trees.
At number two, it's two dirt...
Two dirty what?
I did not mean to get grubby so early on. Two turtle doves.
Oh, not two turtle doves.
No, not two turtle doves. And I discovered a gentleman who I feel like I've spoken about on the podcast before, but maybe you can remember, called Harry Norman Turtle Dove. And he is an American novelist, and as far as I can tell, pretty much the godfather of speculative fiction or alternate history. Alternate history or counterfactual history is basically either studying history or writing novels based on the most obvious one, what if the Nazis won the Second World War? Harry Turtledove is both a master of this and insanely prolific. Prolific to the sort of level where I'm not sure he's actually a good author. He's just written so many words that he's beaten his audience into submission. He was born in LA. And his paternal grandparents were Romanian Jews, and they emigrated there at the turn of the century. He dropped out during his freshman year at Caltech and moved to UCLA, and he completed an undergraduate degree and then received a PhD in something I think you would enjoy, Barry, Byzantine history.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. And his first two novels were published under the pseudonym Eric G. Iverson for the reason that he thought no one would buy his real name being Turtle Dove. And decided, since he was writing fantasy, that something more Nordic would be appreciated. He's written, as I said, tens, if not hundreds of books, but I'll tell you about one of my favourites. He wrote this book, it's called The Two Georges, and he wrote it in collaboration with Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is it any good?
Well, see, I'm fascinated by the world. The title of the book refers to a fictional painting by the painter Gainsborough that commemorated an agreement between George Washington and George III, which led to a peaceful ending of the American Revolution. And so it is set two centuries after that in a place called the North American Union, because the United States and Canada in this novel became one self-governing dominion within the British Empire. Alaska was retained by the Russians. Now, happily in this world, Native Americans fared much better than in our own current timeline, and there exists within it the Iroquois and Cherokee Nation, who keep much of their land and have autonomy within these states. Following the peaceful negotiation ending the American, what would have been the American War of Independence, the French Revolution was suppressed at the storming of the Bastille by troops under the command of Napoleon Bonaparte and the service of Louis XVI, preserving the Bourbon monarchy well into the 20th century. So by the 20th century, no Nazis to worry about now. France and Spain exist in a French-dominated personal union, and this Holy Alliance also controls most of Latin America and North Africa, ruled under the monarchy of François IV. Slavery was abolished under the British Empire in 1833, including many slaves in North America. So, in this world, many emancipated African Americans prospered, gained education, and experienced rapid upward social mobility in the 19th century rather than the 20th century. However, Barry, I have some bad news. Who do you think in this world are the minority sort of take the place of African Americans and suffer?
Is it the Jews or the Irish?
Bingo! It's the Irish Americans.
Yay!
They remain poor, working class, and having to subsist on hard physical labour.
Oh, God.
This creates a bitter jealousy amongst the Irish community, and they come to support a terrorist organisation called the Sons of Liberty.
We'd never do that.
No, not at all. So as this world progresses, it's the empires of Great Britain, the Holy French Alliance, and Russia are the major powers in the 20th century. So I just love this alternate world that he's created. I'm going to tell you about a couple of others alternate ones he created in A World of Difference.
Did he write any more with Richard Dreyfuss?
No, that's the only one.
Oh, that's a shame. They're not going to need a bigger library then.
Very good. 1990s world of difference, there is the alternative history where a fourth planet of our solar system named Minerva instead of Mars, and the Viking space probe goes past it in the 1970s and sends back one picture of an alien creature swinging a stick before losing contact. I'd love to tell you that that is the start of an incredible baseball novel.
Or a John Lewis Christmas advert.
Yeah.
Sorry, tried to keep the podcast seasonal.
Yes. But instead, the Soviets and the Americans get involved in an arms race to reach the planet, and then both of missions basically fight a Cold War proxy war, with both missions backing rival primitive groups in a tribal Minervan war.
What?
But the other one that I really want to read is Ruled Britannia from 2002, where the Spanish Armada did conquer England and forced Shakespeare to write a play about how great Philip II was. But at the same time, Shakespeare becomes a mouthpiece for the English underground, and he writes a resistance play about Boudicca's rebellion, and Boudicca becomes analogous with the imprisoned Elizabeth
I. Wow, that's quite cool.
That's a play I want to see staged at the National Theatre.
Yeah.
So, listen, readers, I know a lot of you out there will be into this sort of stuff. Go out, read Harry Turtledove's oeuvre for us, and let me know whether the books themselves are better than the summaries that I've given you.
Very good. At number three, Three French Hens. Cecil Sharp, again, he suggests that the adjective French in Three French Hens doesn't literally mean French. He just means birds from somewhere else. I mean, using it as sort of a foreign cipher. But obviously the hen in France and the Gallic rooster is a national symbol of some sort. It sort of represents France as a nation, as opposed to Marianne, who represents France as a state. And it's sort of the Republic, apparently.
I mean, I love that the two representations of France are a cock and a woman with her waps out.
Yeah, it's very on brand for France there.
Yeah.
And the rooster is also a symbol of the Wallonia region and the French community in Belgium as well. Suetonius, the ancient Roman writer, he wrote in the 12 Caesars that in Latin, the word for rooster is Gallus, and Gauls was also Gallus. So they were homonyms. Gallic symbol, a Gallic rooster, does seem to be, you know, there does seem to be a link there, although it wasn't used as a sacred animal by the Gauls in any sense, and there was no Gallic nation at the time. There was just lots of, you know, various tribes and so on. However, Mercury was often portrayed with a cockerel at the time, and Mercury was quite popular with the continental Celts. It was one of the Roman gods who had sort of caught on elsewhere. Julius Caesar even wrote about it in his History of the Gallic Wars. He said that Mercury was the god most revered in Gaul. And the Irish god, Lug, was also linked to Mercury as well. So they began to sort of intermingle a little bit then. However, the cockerel was sort of used as a pun by France's enemies at this time. Because Gallus meant both cockerel and rooster, this is sort of any of the Latin enemies of the Gauls would sort of use it to sort of poke fun at them. But later on, it seems that they began to adopt it. Instead of, they reclaimed the rooster as a proper Christian symbol and a symbol of the kings of France, because prior to being arrested in the Bible, Jesus predicts that Peter will deny him three times before the rooster crows in the following morning. So when the rooster crows, Peter remembers Jesus' words, having denied him three times. And so it's crowing sort of symbolizes the victory of light over darkness, and it's the potential of a new day, and it's, you know, symbolizes the return of Christ and all these various things. And so during the Renaissance, it very much then becomes a symbol of France as a Catholic state. So it's got Christian tones very much. And that's why a lot of weather vanes have cocks on them and roosters.
Oh, because it's representative of Christianity.
Yeah, so you get a lot of them on churches, obviously, and you get a cockerel on top of it. The 1998 FIFA World Cup, hosted by France, had an anthropomorphic rooster as its mascot, called Footix. And in 2019, the FIFA Women's World Cup was hosted by France, and it had a anthropomorphic female chicken, known as Etty, as its mascot. And she was depicted as being the daughter of Footix.
That's adorable. And also because, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to say it, you can't have a mascot of the Women's World Cup being a giant cock.
No. And the French National Rugby League team are known as the Chanticleer, which is a reference to what the French version of Cock-a-Doodle-Doo is the cockerel song. But I just read about domestic chickens in general. Do you want to have a guess at how many chickens there are worldwide. This is from a study in 2018, but it's probably very similar.
Bet we're outnumbered, aren't we?
Okay,
so if there's about 7.5-8 billion humans, how many chickens are there for every human? I'm going to say there are 5 chickens for every human, which would mean that there are 40 billion chickens on the planet.
A little too much. We only get... You're a bit too greedy. There's about 3 chickens for every human. There's 23.7 billion chickens worldwide. I mean, I don't know. In one sense, you're like, oh, great, I get 3 whole chickens to eat all to myself. Or, oh my God, in my head, I'm going, could I genuinely fight off 3 chickens?
Well, it depends whether they're like trained cockfighters.
If they all just suddenly turned on us all at once and split up 3-1, could I genuinely overpower 3 chickens? I'm not sure.
No, you're right. There is, because there is the whole thing about, you know, you as a human being are covered in billions upon billions of tiny bacterial life, or there's, you know, trillions of ants, but there's something about 24 billion chickens just biding their time.
In ancient Egypt, chickens were known as the bird that gives birth every day because they are indeterminate layers. They will lay eggs to replace any eggs that have been removed from the nest, which is why we domesticate them, I guess. I just love this. Chickens are the most closely related creature to dinosaurs than any other bird species. Genetic studies have shown that chickens have basically not changed very much at a genomic level than any other bird, since that have evolved since the Cretaceous and Paleogene extinction event. So
they really are the equivalent of kind of like the great 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 grandchild of Abraham Lincoln working in a Chick-fil-A, you know, like these great beasts that roamed the world, and what's left is a fucking joke bit of bland food.
Yeah, Jurassic Park would be a very different movie if it started with a chicken.
I mean, okay, if that doesn't exist already, more inventive listeners than us, make the YouTube... I guarantee this will be a YouTube viral hit of Jurassic Park, but with chickens.
Yeah, I would so be in for that. Clever girl. So that's what I've learned about French hens.
At number 4, ladies and gentlemen, we have 4 calling birds. There's a lot of birds in this, aren't there? Well, I suppose it's because at Christmas, do they have the bird and a bird and a bird and a bird? Some places will have had a bird and a bird and a bird and a bird.
Yeah, like turducken, where you put a hen inside a duck inside a turkey.
Yeah, I can't hear of turducken and not think of Ken and Ryu from Street Fighter just hoying foul at each other. The lyric is not 4 calling birds. It could be, from different times, 4 canary birds, 4 mocking birds, or more probably 4 collie birds. And a collie bird, do you know what type of bird a collie bird is?
Black. It was a regional, it was a sort of a vernacular slang term for black. Coal black, wasn't it?
Yeah, very good. So I looked up a little bit about blackbirds. They were seen as being sacred yet destructive by the Greeks, and were said to die if they consumed pomegranates.
Oh.
Yeah. And obviously the...
were pomegranates the ancient Greek version of Mentos?
Yeah.
Feeding Mentos and Diet Coke to pigeons and watching them explode.
I love the thought of exploding pigeons.
In place of fireworks.
Yes, well that's what...
DIY fireworks.
In the reality in which cats evolved into the primary species on Earth rather than humans, that's what they have on Guy Fawkes Night.
Yeah.
But it works for all birds. So if they want to have a really big firework, they fill a bald eagle full of crumbs.
Oh, I love the colours when they blow up a peacock.
Yeah. And obviously, what the worst bit of that is that the cat's pet human is hiding in, underneath the shed, shivering as they hear all the birds exploding everywhere. The other place where people will have heard about blackbirds, this is probably just a British rhyme, but it's the nursery rhyme, sing a song of sixpence, a pocket full of rye, 4-20 blackbirds baked in a pie, which obviously at medieval banquets they used to do as a coup de grace, where they would cut open the pie and blackbirds would fly out, I presume, shitting everywhere.
Yeah, I think we've talked about that. Heston Blumenthal did a sort of a Tudor banquet on one of his TV shows once and did I can't remember if it was blackbirds, but he did a pie of some sort where birds flew out of it, or there were birds involved, and then they just perched in the rafters above the diners shitting on them.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely disgusting, but I discovered the provenance of the song, Sing a Song of Sixpence. Do you know what it was concocted and written for? It is quite sinister reasons.
Now, usually these things are plague or prostitutes, aren't they?
I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable guess, but no.
Sorry, that's another Renaissance Channel 5 game show. Welcome to Plague or Prostitutes, hosted by Rylan and Vernon Kay.
Rylan's team Plague and Vernon's team Prostitutes.
What was it? Is it war? Is it anti-Irish or anti-Catholic?
No, it's another P. It's piracy.
Oh, cool.
And it was used as a coded message to recruit crew members for pirate vessels. So, because not all privateers had letters of marque from the government, it was still illegal, obviously, to be a pirate and to be a member of a pirate's crew. So, in order to recruit crew members, they had to be a little bit sly about it. So, this was a specific rhyme used by Blackbeard and his core crew to recruit members to join him. So, I'm going to take you through it and do a little bit of textual analysis here. So, sing a song of sixpence, that's the standard payment for Blackbeard. If you work as part of his crew, you get sixpence a day. A pocketful of rye refers to the leather bag that was sort of like a canteen, and that would be your whiskey ration per day. So, 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. Now, Blackbird, Blackbeard is not too big a leap, and the 4 and 20 of them referred to his crew, as we spoke about on our episode about the world's worst pirate with Will Seward. And I'm going to give it a shout out here to newer listeners. If you've not listened to that one, me and Barry proudly think it's one of our best. Do go back and listen to it. Blackbeard's modus operandi would be to basically pretend that his ship was damaged in some way and sprung a leak, and set flags that required help either by good-natured, honest sailors or other pirates who'd think, oh, ho, ho, we can raid this ship. And once they'd come aboard, he would then attack them. And so the 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie was basically a reference to his crew members hiding inside the pie of their broken ship.
They shouldn't be sailing in a pie. No wonder it's broken.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Philo pastry,
yeah.
Very poor to use aboard the ocean waves. When the pie was opened, the birds began to sing, is basically when people came aboard his ship, then the blackbirds, as crew members, would burst out and attack. Was that not a tasty dish to set before the king? Well, the king, and this is Blackbeard himself, who did often refer to himself as the king of pirates. Suddenly it all makes sense. The king was in his counting house counting out his money. Just a simple message going, if you come aboard, I am absolutely going to make sure that you can't leave my ship richer than when you came aboard. The queen was in the parlour eating bread and honey. Now, Blackbeard's main vessel for some of his time was called Le Concorde de Nantes, which he captured alongside Benjamin Hornigold. But it became renamed the Queen Anne's Revenge.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And eating bread and honey is simply the ship taking on board supplies in preparation for the next mission. The maid was in the garden, hanging out the clothes. So the waters around the Carolinas and the Caribbean was often referred to as the garden. What do you think hanging out the clothes referred to in terms of piracy?
Is that shore leave when you get to visit prostitutes? I'm sure there's prostitutes in here somewhere.
There are no prostitutes in this, Barry. No, hanging out the clothes is putting up the sails.
Of course it is.
Yeah. And when down came the blackbird and snapped off her nose, which is pretty brutal, but essentially this part is Blackbeard bragging about his plan to sweep in and target ships. And I assure you, this is not just some nonsense theory cooked up by academics. This has got serious historical research on its side, and I double-checked on Snopes, and Snopes says, yes, this is true. So next time you hear a delightful primary school teacher singing this song to your children, she's essentially trying to recruit them for her pirate ship.
Excellent. It's everyone's favourite bit of the song. Five gold rings. Ah, There you go. Everyone, you can download that for your new ringtone for Christmas. Five God Rings is the name of a TV quiz show on ITV, hosted by Philip Schofield. I was not aware of it, but it's been going for a few seasons now. But then I just read about gold in general and the Witwatersrand, or the Rand or the Reef, in South Africa. It's a 56-kilometre long or 35-mile long scarp in South Africa, made of quartzite. It's a bit just sort of a little hill range, mountain range, or ridge. Several rivers form waterfalls, and it was the centre of a gold rush in 1886, leading to the establishment of Johannesburg as a mining town nearby, as a place for the miners to live and to export their findings from. The amount of gold that has been extracted from the Witwatersrand is insane. In fact, so much gold has been extracted from there. That's why the South African currency is called the Rand. It has produced over 1.5 billion ounces of gold. That is nearly a quarter of all gold accounted for above ground on planet Earth.
Good Lord.
Yeah. However, do you want to guess... In terms of, like, the standard units of measurement, down from, like, a handful up to, you know, a whale's, what could you fit all of the gold ever mined into?
Oh, gosh, I bet it's not very much. I bet it's something like a mini.
It's a bit more than that, but it's an Olympic swimming pool. All of the gold mined in human history could fit into an Olympic swimming pool, which is mind-boggling. And a human body contains gold. We've got 0.2 milligrams of gold inside us. But do you know where most of the gold in the world is? About 20 million tons of it?
That's unmined.
Yeah. Specifically, where is it?
Specifically, you mean country?
Yeah. Whereabouts? Roughly on planet. If we were playing the game, Five Gold Rings, and I'd given you a map of planet Earth, where would most of the gold be? Or certainly 20 million tons of it.
I am going to say China.
It would be in the ocean. And where in the ocean? Literally in the water. There is gold in the ocean water, which we have talked about on the show before.
Yeah.
Is he Francis Ford? Something Jernigan? Something, I think his Jernigan was the guy's name who tried to sell the idea of extracting gold from water. It's ridiculously difficult to do, and the concentration level is tiny. It's, you know, parts per trillion, so it's really, really difficult to get. However, if gold is worth, say, about $42 per gram, which is often is, or $42.50 per gram, the amount of gold that's in the world's oceans would be roughly worth $771 trillion.
Wow.
The United States gross domestic product in 2016 was $18.57 trillion. That's 41 times less.
So what you're saying is that whilst global warming may be bad for some of us, whoever gets to be the Lord of Waterworld will automatically become the richest leader in the world.
Yeah, there's gold in them there waves.
Yeah.
The entire world's domestic product in 2014 was $78.28 trillion, so 10 times the world's domestic product is in gold in the ocean water.
I just want to see someone do that pitch on Dragon's Den.
Yeah. So there you go, gold rings.
Tremendous. Right, well, we know what we're aiming for next year. Next, continuing the theory of gold, we've got six geese a-laying. I had a look at the Golden Goose, specifically the Golden Goose Award, which was established in 2012 in America, and it officially recognises scientists whose federally funded research has led to innovations or inventions that have significantly impacted on human society.
Ah.
But it's specifically meant to be about stuff that you wouldn't initially think would help society. So in the way that people go, why are we searching for a Higgs boson? What is the point of CERN? Go, well, actually, without it, we wouldn't have the internet as we know it. Aside from curiosity. And it's existed in response to an award that was set up by a Democrat senator from the 70s called William Proxmire, and he put out a monthly Golden Fleece Award for federal spending that he believed were wasting state money. He makes a point in some ways, but is also an absolute jackass in other ways. So some of the things that he awarded the Golden Fleece for were the National Science Foundation spending $103,000 to compare the aggressiveness created in sunfish that drink tequila rather than gin. The National Institute for Mental Health spent $97,000 studying, among other things, what went on in a Peruvian brothel. The researchers say they made repeated visits there in the interests of accuracy. Sure you did, lads.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The United States Department of Commerce in 1979 spent $20,000 building a 10-story replica of the Great Wall of China in Bedford, Indiana. The money proved insufficient and the site is currently abandoned and has not managed to box in Mike Pence, sadly.
Hang on, is the Great Wall of China 10 stories tall in real life?
Probably in some places.
Okay. I've not been. I mean, I didn't imagine it was going to be sort of ankle level.
Yeah, that's the Great Wall of China as played out in Spinal Tap.
That's why they only ever want us to look at it from space.
Yeah.
They don't want you to get too close to it. You'll realise how tiny it is.
Oh, yeah, it's all just about PR. That's all it is. And one other one. The United States Department of Defense once ran a study that cost $3,000 to determine if people in the military should carry umbrellas in the rain. So he makes a good point. On the other side, he was sued for libel by behavioral scientist Ronald Hutchinson, who spent $500,000 to determine why monkeys clench their jaws. And Proxmire said, "This is nonsense." And Hutchinson said, "I shall see you in court, my friend. I would like $8 million in damages." No. And the case was later settled out of court. But he's also been accused by the president of Pixar, Ed Catmull, of having a chilling effect on research. Because, again, research for research's sake sometimes leads to all sorts of important and exciting pieces of progress. I'm just going to give you three. The study of pieces of coral by Coralline Ceramics has led to the development of bone grafts created from them.
Cool.
Similarly, research into rat massage has helped with ways of keeping premature babies healthy.
Okay, but I want to have been a fly on the wall when a supervisor walked into a lab to find one of their students massaging a rat for the first time. And that student had to think really quickly and go, it's for research. I think it'll do something for babies. That's why I've got the baby oil. The candles, yeah, they were just a choice.
It's what's known in the trade as the reverse ratatouille.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's my golden goose and my golden fleece.
Very, very good. Next up is Seven Swans Are Swimming. Let's have a go and see if Ben can name the six species of swan.
Black.
Correct.
White.
No.
Okay. Alabaster.
No.
Cream.
No.
Off-white. Cappuccino.
No.
Canadian goose in disguise.
Yeah, sure.
Angry, furious, spitting... the Queen's Lunch.
Okay, that's more than six at this point.
And the Portman.
I didn't realise we'd quite reached the end of the extent of your knowledge so quickly there. Black Swan, Whooper Swan, Trumpeter Swan, Tundra Swan, Black-necked Swan, and the Mute Swan is the one is the white one that everyone will be thinking of. Can a swan break your arm?
Only if it knows jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, pretty much. It's a myth. There are no reports of a swan ever breaking someone's arm. The bones in their wings are quite thin, small, and quite hollow, so they're more likely to break their own bones if they try to karate chop your arm. However, in 2010, a swan was responsible for killing a man.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a guy called Anthony Hensley was in a kayak, and the swan charged it on the water, and eyewitnesses says it looked like the swan was actively trying to knock him out of the boat. Some eyewitnesses then said it looked like the swan was then trying to stop him getting to safety, which is even more chilling. But yeah, so they can be very territorial and very vicious. But the thing that everyone knows about swans, it seems, and the thing that Ben referenced there, is that the Queen of England owns all of the mute swans in Britain.
And is the only person allowed to eat them?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it dates back to the 12th century when, you know, swans were considered a delicacy and a staple at only the very finest banquets. So the crown claimed all of the mute swans in the country, and they basically sort of licensed a couple of companies to who could use them. So basically, there's a lot of the companies of the city of London, so the guild, the former merchant guilds. So there are two companies that still observe the tradition of owning swans on the Thames. They're the worshipful companies of vintners and of dyers. And they're not marked anymore. In the past, they'd have all been marked, royal swans were. But basically, an unmarked mute swan on the Thames is regarded as belonging to the Queen by default. So she can just, you know, walk along the Thames going, that's mine, that's mine, that's mine. got. Peacock, ooh, need.
Yeah. Peacock, ooh, it's shiny.
Yeah. And in the third week of July, the Queen had a swan keeper, an officially maintained swan keeper, whose job it would be to document and account for all of the swans on the Thames. In 1993, the role was split into two. They have the swan warden and the swan marker. The swan warden is a guy called Christopher Perrins, who's an ornithologist from the University of Oxford. He monitors the health of swans during the ceremony. And the swan marker organises the event and also keeps tabs on swan welfare all around Britain. It's a guy called David Barber who carries that out. But this ceremony, which is called Swan Upping, the annual Swan Upping ceremony, happens in the third week of July every year, and it lasts for 5 days. And they get 6 rowing boats, 2 for the Crown, and then 2 for the Company of Dyers and 2 for the Company of Vintners. And they put into the Thames at Sunbury, just west of London, and head upstream to Abingdon in a 79-mile, 5-day journey. Each flag flying, each boat flying a flag or a pennant, indicating which company or the royal household that they're representing. The Queen took part in the ceremony once in 2009. And the companies all honour her, the uppers, as they're all called, all honour her by pouring a glass of port and raising it in her name before they carry out the ceremony. And as she's the owner of all the swans, she has a name befitting of her station, it says here, Seigneur of the Swans. It's just one of those daft British things that they still do for no real reason. Just that they've been doing it since the 12th century and no one's told them it's okay to stop.
It's the sort of thing, and I was thinking about this the other day, whenever there's a piece of British pageantry, you'll always get some lickspittle bootlicker newscaster turning to camera going, it's just what we do best in this country.
It's just people dressed up in silly costumes counting swans. Which sounds like a Monty Python sketch when you say it out loud.
It really does. Do you know what, the EU, you're best rid of us, you really are. Swans are swimming, and after that comes maids are milking. For this, I looked up the legend of the dun cow.
Oh, yeah.
Which, funnily enough, is I saw yesterday, is one of the... It's the earliest still existing piece of Irish storytelling is the Book of the Dun Cow from, I believe, the 7th century. There's various different versions of the legend, but there's one from Dunsmuir Heath, which is in Warwickshire, and the Dun Cow is said to be a savage beast roaming the heath, which is reputed to be slain by a chap called Guy of Warwick, At Warwick Castle, one of the ribs of the dun cow is said to still be exhibited. It's not a cow rib. It is a narwhal tusk. And the fable held that the cow belonged to a giant that was kept nearby in Shropshire, and its milk was inexhaustible. But one day an old woman who had filled her pail wanted to fill her sieve as well. And this so enraged the animal that she broke loose from the fold and wandered round through Dunsmuir Heath until she was finally slain by Guy of Warwick. There are similar versions of it all over the country. Rather than the cow running away, the cow died in shock when, instead of it being a milkmaid, it was an old witch wanted to get extra milk from it. There's indeed other versions of the cow's rib around the country. In a place called Cowheel near Grimsar, rather than it being a narwhal tusk, it's probably an aurochs rib, an aurochs being a prehistoric cow. Two last things of it. The Dun Cow in Shrewsbury is one of the oldest pubs in the United Kingdom. How old do you think it is?
Oh, they all say they were around in like the 12th century.
Older than that, mate.
Oh, really? Go on. Yes. I well believe it is one of the 170 oldest pubs in Britain.
1085.
Okay, good. They're just nipping under the tape to get in the William the Conqueror.
And last of all, there is a pub called the Dun Cow in Sedgefield in County Durham that in 2003 was visited by Tony Blair and President George W. Bush. And the fable of a cow that seems to constantly give as much milk as you want, but when you ask for just that little bit more, it goes rogue and wanders around the estate and has to be killed. It just feels like narratively pleasing that that's where those two went. It just sort of fits nicely with our now lapdog relationship with the United States of America. So there are my maids a-milking.
Yeah, the Book of the Dun Cow is in the Royal Irish Academy in Dublin. It's a 12th century, I think it's a 12th century manuscript. It's the oldest existing manuscript written in Irish, as opposed to in the Irish language, as opposed to in Latin or anything like that. So, and it has lots of sort of folk tales and legends and bits and pieces like that. It's one of the great treasures of Irish literature.
It's basically sort of like, if the Book of Kells is god tier, then this is sort of the next one down.
Yeah. Next up is Nine Ladies Dancing, and I took this quite literally. I have facts about nine famous female dancers.
Great.
At number one, Anna Pavlova.
Not at number one, at number 9A.
Sorry, yeah, 9A. At number 9A. Anna Pavlova, famed ballet dancer. She died in a hotel in The Hague. And do you know what her last words were?
Oh, I was going to say either those curtains go or I do, but that's
wild.
Wild, yeah. I think it was wallpaper Wilde didn't like, but yeah. Apparently, Anna Pavlova's last words were, "Get my swan costume ready."
Yes, those are wonderful. And the idea of like her tottering up to the pearly gates dressed as a swan and Peter going, "I think there's been an administrative error."
Yeah, apparently it was quite a nice lady.
Sorry, the idea of a dyer going to have a dressed as a swan and being chased by the queen going, no, you belong on my dinner table, Pavlova.
You need to be upped. It's a Pavlova hidden inside a swan. What a dramatic delicacy. It must be a Heston Blumenthal creation.
Yeah, swan Pavlova is definitely what the Queen has on Boxing Day.
Josephine Baker, mm-hmm. Great pioneer of modern dance in the early part of the 20th century. She went on to be quite involved in the civil rights movement in the USA. And in fact, after Martin Luther King was shot, Coretta Scott King asked her if she would become the new figurehead, the new leader of the civil rights movement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Josephine Baker said no because she didn't want to leave her children. She was, you know, she was quite happy contributing from where she was, but not being right out front and centre. Which, given that the previous guy just been shot, you don't blame her, really. Ginger Rogers, famous for doing exactly what Fred Astaire did, but backwards and in heels, of course. Ginger Rogers isn't her name, oddly enough. She was born Virginia Catherine McMath. And in 1934, alongside all of her work with Fred Astaire, she starred in one of the first films to be co-directed and co-written by a woman, a drama called Finishing School by Wanda Tuchok. Yeah, so well done, Ginger Rogers. And she was granted the status of Admiral in the Texas Navy in 1936 for her achievements in the world of film and dance as well. Unlike Nebraska, which we talked about recently, Texas at least does have a coastline. Margot Fonteyn. She was one of the greatest ballet dancers of the 20th century. She was given the title of Prima Ballerina Assoluta by the Royal Ballet in England. And Prima Ballerina obviously means sort of the leading ballerina. You take on the lead roles and dance the lead roles in ballets at your opera house and in your company and around the world. But Prima Ballerina Assoluta, so it's not like an official title per se, but it's one that's reserved in the ballet world for only the very best of the best. And she's one of the few people who's been referred to as that. And she was given the title by the Royal Ballet in 1979 on her 60th birthday, sanctioned by Queen Elizabeth II because she was patron of the company at the time. She was also Chancellor of the University of Durham during the 1980s. She was one of the women commemorated on a Woman of Achievement stamp in Britain in 1996. And there's a statue of her in her birthplace in Reigate, possibly the highest of all the honours I've just mentioned. And she's, you know, she was a CBE and a dame. She was Dame Margot Fonteyn. But the thing I liked most of all is in 1961, she was considering retiring at this point. And 1961 is when Rudolf Nureyev defected from the Kirov Ballet while he was dancing in Paris. He defected to the West while dancing in Paris. And Margot Fonteyn was sort of, like I said, was thinking about retiring, but instead she was lured to come dance with him There was nearly a 20-year age difference between them, and so she was still a bit reluctant because she didn't want to look crap alongside this young, brilliant, sprightly dancer. But they became a huge international hit, dancing with each other. On the 21st of February 1962, they danced together in Giselle, the first time Nureyev had danced Giselle, to a sellout crowd. And they received a 15-minute ovation and 20 curtain calls for the performance.
I just, whenever I think about these things, like, where is it, the Sundance and the Cannes Film Festival, it's almost like de rigueur to give these incredibly long-standing ovations, and at any party conference. And I, even after something I adored, if the Beatles, if two of them came back from the dead and they played the entirety of Sgt. Pepper on the roof of Abbey Road, note perfect, after 5 minutes of standing ovation, I'd be pretty fucking bored.
Well, I don't know, maybe they kept dancing during the curtain call.
Reasonable.
Yeah, that might explain it. Ruth St. Denis, or Ruth St. Denis, she was a contemporary of Isadora Duncan and, again, early 20th century, and Josephine Baker, early 20th century, danced a lot in Paris, brought back sort of mystic sort of feel to her dance, all of that slightly orientalist stuff. But again, the reason they were so groundbreaking at the time is they weren't too concerned with, you know, the steps and the technique. It was more about the expressive movement of the body, which is where they originated modern dance. But she, in 1910, she was the first solo dancer to play in New York theatre on her own, basically. She was the star attraction at a New York theatre, so she was a trailblazer back in America. And in 1925, she created a dance called Tragica, the first dance without music, she called it.
Was it without music, or was he scoring some of John Cage's music?
Maybe she forgot to hire an orchestra.
And then styled it out.
Yeah.
He's like, what I'm going to do, I'm just going to be there massaging a rat with oil for 5 minutes.
Yeah. And Pina Bausch, she died in 2009. She was the director of the Wuppertal Opera Ballet.
If you don't know who Pina Bausch was, her name was what you would see on the screen when Batman hit someone in the 1960s.
Another iconic and trailblazing choreographer, particularly renowned for her work with the Wuppertal Opera Ballet, as I say. From 1973, she was there until she died in 2009, but she only ever signed one-year contracts. She just kept doing, like, rolling contracts. She said, I was always ready to go. I was never meant to stay here in Wuppertal. It just happened. But both Federico Fellini and David Bowie were big fans of hers. Anne Miller, she's a star of classic film musicals, she, particularly for tap dance people, renowned her. Well, she was renowned for being, you know, having the fastest feet in Hollywood. Basically, all the PR people in her studio claimed she could tap 500 times per minute. Yeah.
Good lord.
She could not. They would loop in the sound of 500 taps, you know, ultra fast tapping much later. And in fact, stage floors were often waxed and too slick for actual tap shoes. So she usually danced in shoes with rubber treads on them. And then she would loop in her own taps later on by watching the film back and then danced on a tap board. And then they would loop that several times to make it sound faster as well. So it was all a lie, Anne Miller.
Disgusting.
Two more left. Lola Montez, otherwise known as Elizabeth Gilbert, she was a lover of Liszt, a literal sexy times lover of Liszt, and also a lover of Ludwig I, King of Bavaria. In 1846, she arrived in Munich. Apparently, when they first met, Ludwig asked her publicly if her breasts were real. Her response, apparently, was to tear off her clothes to show that they were. So it seems like they got on like a house on fire immediately. But she became quite unpopular. He wasn't a very dominant personality, and she began to influence him quite a lot. And she was very arrogant, apparently, and bad-tempered. And she wanted to, you know, get Bavarian citizenship. So the Bavarian people were so unhappy about this and about her that he abdicated as king. And finally, Isadora Duncan. She, again, another one of the early 20th century modern dance innovators. She had a very maternal instinct and wanted to foster children, and fostered quite a lot of them. In 1919, she adopted all six of her Isadorables. These were little hand-picked protege dancers that she was training, because she sort of reached the end of her dancing career and was training up the new generation of dancers, and she adopted them all. The girls all took her last name. She insisted they were by her side at all times. It became quite overbearing, and in fact, by the early 1920s, most of the Isadorables had quit.
Oh dear. Hannah, sorry, quit as her backing dancers, but you can't quit being someone's adopted child, can you?
Well, I don't know. Maybe, I feel like if you just refuse to hang around, I think they had stopped dancing, and I think they sort of separated from her as amicably as they could. So there you go. Those are 9 facts about 9 dancing ladies.
Beautifully done and excellently dismounted. And now we're on to 10 lords a-leaping. I had a little skim of lord facts, but we've not yet done world's worst lord, and I think that could well be a 5-hour long episode. And then I found a man who I feel like you might have heard of, Barry. This is the 5th Marquess of Anglesey, Henry Cyril Paget.
Yes, he's awesome.
He is astonishing. So he was born in 1875, the eldest son of the 4th Marquess. And for those who don't know, Anglesey is the biggest island in England and Wales. It's right up off the northwest coast of Wales and was home for way in the distant past for, druids is not a term that they used, but, you know, flamboyant gentlemen with long beards who like stone circles. And at first, young Henry followed the aristocratic script. He went to Eton College. He entered the British Army. At the age of 23, he married to his first cousin, but that's what they did. But within less than a year of getting married, his father passed away, leaving him with the family estate and also the equivalent of an annual income of about 15 million quid. And this, my friends, is where it gets goddamn brilliant.
Yeah. It's so good. I love this guy so much.
He got a reputation for being a lavish spender of money, and he would spend money on jewellery and furs and flamboyant theatrical performances. And imagine if today Freddie Mercury went on RuPaul's Drag Race, and that's where we're at.
Yeah.
He renamed the family's country seat as Anglesey Castle. This is my favourite bit. He converted the chapel there into a 150-seat theatre named the Gaiety Theatre.
Yeah.
And there he took on lead roles in productions ranging from pantomime to comedy to Henry V to Wilde's An Ideal Husband, all the time opulently costumed. He was quite trailblazing. The Gaiety Theatre, when it was refurbished in 1901, it was fitted out with electric stage lighting and reopened as a public entertainment venue, which I think is probably pretty much ahead of its time. My favourite dalliance of his with another famous person, in 1901, he attended the premiere of Conan Doyle's stage adaptation of Sherlock Holmes at the Lyceum. Whilst he was there, his French valet, Julien Gold, took the opportunity to steal 50 grand's worth of Paget's jewellery. And distraught, Paget enlisted the help of Conan Doyle to find the stolen jewels. You've written a detective, you sort this out. And Gold was later arrested at Dover, and he testified that he'd been instructed by a French woman of his acquaintance called Mathilde to steal the jewels. And I love the fact that he was like, Conan Doyle's involved, there's got to be a Mr. Big. And whilst his testimony was believed to be true, he was still sentenced to 5 years imprisonment at the Old Bailey. Sadly for Paget, he got in quite a lot of trouble. By 1904, he'd accumulated £544,000 worth of debt, or in today's money, 60 million quid, and had to be declared bankrupt. And all of his lavish gowns and jewels were sold to pay creditors. And a year later, he died in Monte Carlo, of course, following a long illness with his by then ex-wife at his side. Because you're not going to be surprised to know, guys, and I don't want to sort of like go for an obvious pigeonholing here, but the marriage was not necessarily consummated, because he must be one of history's not so secret gays, right?
The usual giveaway for these things is the fact that his successor destroyed all of his papers after his death. That seems to be. Yeah, he's also the subject of a show by a friend of mine, Serial Davis, called How to Win Against History. If anyone gets a chance to see, I heartily recommend it. Just Google him, because the photos of him are remarkable, and they don't look like they're his from the period. Like, there's a photo of him wearing this amazing like winged headdress where he's sitting on a chair, but it's a armchair, but he's got one leg over one of the chairs and he's sort of like holding his chin a bit. It's like very like Blue Steel, like it's a very 21st century looking pose, and he's wearing dresses and jewels and all. So he's a fabulous looking guy, and probably great fun to hang around.
Yeah, I imagine so. He burned bright and short.
Yes, indeed. Next up is 11 Pipers Piping. And I just read about bagpipes. Do you know, the bagpipe can only play 9 notes from G to A with no sharps or flats. So that probably probably explains why it sounds shit some of the time. Like, it can't quite play the note you wanted to. And they're not Scottish.
They are Basque?
They're from the Middle East. Pipes are mentioned in the Bible. I mean, there are 130 different types of bagpipes around the world. There are 18 of them in France alone.
Is that how the walls of Jericho fell down? It was actually bagpipers.
My mum tells me a story of when she was a baby in her mum's arms. My granny walked into the kitchen holding my mum at one occasion, and some bagpipe music came on the radio, and my mum jumped out of her arms. She hates the sound of bagpipes to this day. But they were from the Middle East. They have them in Egypt and in Greece and in Rome, and Roman legions took them to the British Isles, it seems. In fact, Bulgaria's national instrument is a type of bagpipes named the Cabagaida. So they're not just unique to Scotland. The Illan pipes are an Irish pipe which don't require being blown into. You just squeeze the box to get the sound out of it while you're doing it. Queen Elizabeth II is woken by bagpipers every morning at 9:30.
God, no wonder she looks like a bulldog who swallowed a wasp most time you see her in public.
Yeah, there is a piper to the Queen, the royal piper.
Sorry, that's Prince Philip's nickname.
Prince Philip hates the sound of bagpipes, apparently.
Good.
He doesn't, or certainly he doesn't enjoy the morning alarm call as much as the Queen. In 2019, current piper to the Queen was appointed. He's called Richard Grisdale from the Royal Regiment of Scotland. The post was established in 1843 under Queen Victoria. She'd heard bagpipe music the year before when she and Prince Albert were in Scotland, and liked so much that she employed a royal piper. The guy, first one, was called Angus Mackay, and only 15 people have held the post since then. And the Queen enjoys the music so much that she brings her bagpiper all round the UK with her to every one of her residences, apart from Sandringham, because of lack of accommodation in Sandringham. It's even said, apparently, that the royal bagpiper travels with her more than her own husband. Certainly now he's retired, that's definitely true. But it's basically like, we all travel with our own personal alarm clock, except in the Queen's case, it's a guy with a bagpipe. So yeah, that's my favourite thing I know about bagpipes, is that it's the Queen's alarm clock.
That is superb. And to end, and I'm going to try and keep this light, 12 drummers drumming. You'll see why I'm saying trying to keep it light. Obviously, we've done an episode on the world's worst drummer, TLDR, Buddy Rich, bit of a shit, and I tell a weird ghost story in it. But I decided to look up the most tragic drummer of them all, Mr. Randolph Peter Best.
Oh, Pete Best.
Pete Best, yeah. I didn't know his first name was Randolph either until this morning.
Wow. You can see why, rock star style, you change it to Pete.
Yes, well, rock star in enormous inverted commas. Randolph sort of suits him better. For those who don't know, he is one of the less salubrious fifth Beatles. Obviously, the people more worthy of the title is George Martin or the engineer Neil Aspel or their manager Brian Epstein. Pete Best is sort of on the subs bench, come on, as the fifth Beatle. He was their original drummer and was eventually removed from the band in favour of Ringo Starr, whose style suited the Beatles more and also had a sense of humour and was quite fun to be around. And you've got to feel for Pete Best, because imagine being part of the group that go on to become the greatest group ever. You'll be unsurprised to learn in his later life he did suffer from depression. Why the fuck wouldn't you?
But I'm not Pete Best, I'm Pete Worst. To be fair, if you're a drummer and you've been replaced with Ringo of all people...
No, no, no.
Sorry, listeners, I had to chuck a grenade into Ben's side.
I am not having it. He's not a showy drummer. He's not a technically gifted drummer in the way that others are. Ringo is the perfect drummer for the Beatles and goddamn excellent. Mm. And if you don't, it's not a red rag to a bull. This is just a tedious, commonly held misconception. Go and watch Dave Grohl and Chad Smith from the Chili Peppers talking about how great Ringo Smith is on YouTube. Ringo Smith.
How great Ringo.
Yeah, you see, they're only talking about Ringo Smith. They're not talking about Ringo Starr. So sorry, listeners, I've added about 20 minutes to this podcast now. Ben is deciding whether he continues this rant or defies me by getting back on subject.
Ringo's a very good drummer, leave him alone. when the Beatles first went to Hamburg, where they cut their teeth as a rock and roll band, Pete was the drummer who went with them. And there's just stories that he just doesn't fit in, so that the group got rid of their stage suits and put on the super cool leather jackets and jeans and cowboy boots, mostly because they were tougher and they wouldn't sweat through them in their 10-hour shifts. But Pete Best preferred to play in cooler short-sleeve shirts on stage. So it was basically three Beatles and an accountant on the drums. Similarly, when they were in Hamburg to keep going, Lennon, McCartney, Harrison and Stuart Sutcliffe, who was part of the band there, they all took recreational drugs, partially for fun and partially just to give them the energy to keep going. But Pete Best never bought them or got involved in them.
Oh, what a loser.
Right,
only cool people take drugs.
Look, obviously not only cool people take drugs, but if you're in the Beatles, in Hamburg, in the 1960s, you take drugs. That's what you do.
Ben, I quite like Pete Best because he's resisting peer pressure. And I'd say he was probably a better drummer than Ringo Starr or Ringo Smith. Oh, hang on, listeners. Remember at the start I said don't talk about religion or politics at Christmas. Add the Beatles to it if you're having Christmas with Ben.
You can talk to me about the Beatles, just
but you have to accept out. My rule of law.
Yes! Yes, you do!
And not come out with trite cliches that aren't true. He's not a spectacular drummer. He's the drummer the band needs. Okay?
Oh, dear. I'm so sorry, listeners. I know you don't want to hear Mummy and Daddy fight at Christmas. And yet, here we are.
Look, An Octopus's Garden is a great song, and the drum solos in Rain in the End are wonderful. And the drumming fills on A Day in the Life are unparalleled and could be matched by any drummer on earth. He's excellent.
Whoever's editing this is just going to like slowly fade your voice down. Put in a sometime later and slowly fade it back up to the end.
I just can't stop myself if you besmirch the good name of Ringo. And it hurts me all the more that Ringo is now a Brexit-loving little Englander. Anyway, where were we? Oh, yeah. One other thing with Pete Best, and this is me sort of having a go at him for something that's, you know, actually quite good. When the Beatles were staying in Hamburg, they stayed in an awful little hole in a place called the Bambi Kino, which was a cinema that had a small dirty room with bunk beds out back. The only person who could communicate how much they hated it to the manager, Bruno Koschmider, was Pete Best, because he's the only one who'd studied O-level German. And again, it just feels like such the Pete Best thing. Like, the Beatles are all out shagging around, drinking, taking uppers, and he's the one doing the admin with the manager of the German hotel at the back of a cinema they're staying in. He was treated pretty unfairly by the Beatles. It was George Martin who wanted to get rid of him because George Martin, Sir George Martin, the man who made the Beatles what they were, Barry, he said that Ringo Starr was a better drummer than Pete Best. He valued Ringo Starr. So don't take it up with me. Take it up with Knight of the Realm, George Martin.
Will.
I mean, don't now because it'll involve the pentagram and some dribbly candles. The way they got rid of him was very much they left Brian Epstein to get rid of him and they didn't talk to him anymore. And he said to them, they don't want you in the band. And it was, and obviously Paul was very sort of, oh, we didn't really sort of match. We were a wacky trio and Pete was a bit more sensible and he didn't really get our jokes. Whereas Lennon, when interviewed, said, we were pretty sick of Pete Best because he was a lousy drummer. He never improved, you know. The happy end to the story is that when the anthology came out and a number of tracks that Pete Best played on were broadcast, he got between £1 and £4 million in sales.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. The story I read said that McCartney rang him up and tried to build bridges. The way Pete Best told it was Neil Aspinall, who was an engineer and friend of the band, did it. So turns out that the Beatles weren't perfect, beatific saints of music, as I've always thought. They could occasionally be a bit shitty, but...
There we go, folks. We've got what we need. We'll clip that. Van der Velde says Beatles are shit.
I'm done.
Don't deny I can't clip all that together. Listen, folks, thank you very much for listening to our special Christmas episode all about the 12 days of Christmas and their associated gifts. We hope it brings you some festive joy at this time of year. Thank you for listening to us all through 2020. It's been quite the year, I think we're all agreed. And however you're celebrating its end, we hope that next year will be much better and you find a little bit of peace, quiet, happiness, silliness, something like that in the this little festive week. I think we're looking forward to 2021 as much as anyone else.
Yeah, let's press the reset button and enjoy a phoenix from the flames here. But yeah, from us, have a very merry Yuletide and Saturnalia.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Five gold rings.